The following podcast contains adult subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Hey everybody, welcome to this interview episode with John Morris. He is the author of The League of Regrettable Sidekicks, as well as Regrettable Superheroes and Regrettable Supervillains. It is a series of books that illuminates us in the world of terrible, terrible comic book ideas that somehow managed to get past every artist, writer, and editor and still go into print. John, how are you doing today, man?
Well, I'm doing swell. How are you folks doing?
Oh, doing really good. So this series of books, and specifically the book that we're talking about today, the newest one, Regrettable Sidekicks, League of Regrettable Sidekicks, this series shows us that not every superhero idea is great. But somehow when I read these books, because I've checked out Sidekicks and I've read the superheroes one, but I haven't had the chance to read the supervillains one. But
well, let's pause the podcast if you want to go do that now.
That might take me a little while. I'm a slow reader.
I'll wait. It's fine.
So coming back from me reading the book. No, just kidding. I find that there are things that, even though they're terrible, I fall in love with them anyways. You know, when you're looking at all these just terrible ideas, are there things that you're like, I need to include this because I love it too, even though it's awful?
There's almost nothing that's in the book that isn't there because I love it. I've been writing about these weird old forgotten comic book characters for something like 20 years. And if I didn't love them when I started, and I kind of did, I would have no choice but to basically be married to them now. But yeah, I mean, there's very few characters in the book that I ever feel any particular distaste for. And even then, I don't think they'd be in the book if there wasn't something about them that was a little weird. In the superheroes book way back in the day, I made kind of a little bit of noise about not really liking one of the characters too terribly much. He was a 1980s Black Lightning ripoff called Sonic, whose power was that he had amped up a Walkman to give him Sonic superpowers. And there were a lot of reasons to dislike him, but then I kind of realized he's using a superpowered Walkman. That is fascinating. And that is completely unique in comics. So obviously there's something at least lovable about that character, even if I didn't ultimately like him in the end.
So talking about how, you know, you've been writing about these kind of off-kilter and like off the beaten path superheroes for 20 years, like how in the world did you get into the business of writing about about this stuff?
Well, I'm very, very old. I remember the summer of love. I did serve our nation proudly in Korea. So I was around when the internet was really starting, to the degree that I had a job that gave you a free web page back when most people didn't even have web pages or know what they were. And I needed something to write about. So I had grown up in a house full of comic books. Both my parents had collected. My pop is German, and he taught himself how to read English entirely from comic books. So we grew up in a house of not just books, but really weird ones from the 40s and 50s. So, you know, Uncle Wiggily and Clue Comics and just a raft of humor books featuring characters that don't exist anymore. So when I had an opportunity to write about comics, which was the only thing I could think to do on my website, I went for the ones that nobody else wanted to talk about. I think my first article was The Champions, which was the old Marvel Comics team of Ghost Rider and Hercules and Iceman that made no sense, but was just a wonderful sort of accidental frisson of weirdness.
Right.
Yeah.
So
that had largely been it. Yeah.
So with this original like iteration of it on like an early website, at what?
Oh yeah, I've got a website.
Like at what point were you like, this would make a great book? Like what kind of drove you into making it into a book?
Well, I tell you, I wanted to make it a book from day one, but I was looking out at that sea of copyright and having no interest whatsoever of navigating it. So I was just very happy to write on my blog over and over about, you know, whatever weird comics came into my path of vision. But I got called by the nice folks over at Quirk Books, or contacted anyway, after This American Life reran my interview, which I think is like a 1997 or a 2000 interview. It's very old. But they heard it on repeat and gave me a call, and those nice folks handled all the copyright navigation, so it just allowed me the opportunity to write about them.
That's awesome. That was actually going to be one of my next questions, is how in the world do you get the pictures into the books? Because the copyright mess that has got to be, especially with some of the older books where...
Well, the older books are a lot easier, actually.
Oh, okay.
Because most of those have fallen into the public domain, so they're free to reproduce. It's the closer you get to the modern day is where it gets tricky, because you're dealing with a lot of active copyrights and sometimes trademarks. And so, which I think I just made sound like active copyrights were a wolf and trademarks were a much larger wolf, but I just sort of mean they're both complicated. But of course, you're dealing with you have a book called Regrettable Superheroes, and then you put a bunch of characters that are currently being published by major publishers into that book. You get a little nervous. You feel like they might take some offense at it.
What's fascinating about it, and, you know, obviously my first exposure to this idea was the Regrettable Superheroes book. And
sure.
As a consequence, like that book actually is the book that introduced me to the works of Fletcher Hanks with Fantoma and Stardust. And then I became obsessed with that thing. And we actually interviewed the guy that edited the book that's all of, you know, the collected works of Fletcher Hanks that they've been able to find, you know. And so there was like,
fantastic.
It's like one of those things where, you know, like you said, at some point you love these characters in some way, and that's how this was for me. So it's not really an insult to put them in this book, because on some level they're lovable. They're dopey, and they kind of highlight the weirdness that is like comic book culture.
Oh yeah. I mean, I definitely intend the book to be a celebration. Very early on in the foreword of every single book, I make it a point to mention that when we say regrettable, we don't mean that the character's bad. We mean that there's some misfortune that befell them. Either they were an idea that came too early or too late, or they debuted at a time when the racks were completely stuffed with titles and they just couldn't, you know, come to get in anybody's line of sight. There's always something that keeps these characters from really reaching their potential or reaching the best audience they could reach. And that's what makes them regrettable. And that's also what makes it so rewarding to see when one of these characters does make it big. I had put Squirrel Girl into the Superheroes volume. And literally the day that it went to press, I found out that my friend Erica Henderson was drawing a new Squirrel Girl series. And that went on to be incredibly popular. It still is to this day. And I'm so happy, because that's such the reason that Squirrel Girl had been included in Regrettable Volume 1. And I know that you might think it's because she's a squirrel. It's because she had been introduced to sort of represent a return to the fun Silver Age of comics. But after her debut, she kind of disappeared for about 10 years. So she was regrettable because she could have been the hallmark of a new wave of fun comics. And she is. That eventually came true. So it's very worth... Yeah, I'm very happy to see that happen. I'm very happy to hear that you were introduced to Fletcher Hanks by this. This is sort of why I write the book, is to introduce people to stuff they hadn't heard of before.
You know, it's interesting, because I read I think it was the Fantoma one that really hooked me. I was like, that sounds amazing. Like, where do I find that stuff? And then so I, you know, obviously my first step is go on Amazon and see if there's a book about this guy. And it is a phenomenal adventure to see him like literally copy and paste his own panels, and like these completely amoral heroes that aren't really heroes and end up killing like entire planets of people. It's just so bizarre.
Yeah, there's something about Fletcher Hanks's stories that definitely feels like you're reading a creation myth from a culture that is long dead.
Yeah.
I get Gilgamesh. When I read Stardust the Super Wizard, I'm like, this is about on par with Gilgamesh, as near as I can tell.
It always reminds me of H.P. Lovecraft stuff, because everything is so amoral, and there's some being that's so much more powerful than the petty humans that are invading his space. Like it's just weird. It's extra weird. And that's what I love about these Regrettable books, is it introduces you to truly weird concepts, like not necessarily bad, but just so bizarre that you can't help but think, who greenlit this?
Right. Well, that's one of the I'm a huge fan of the golden age of comics, and it's almost entirely because there were no rules. And a lot of these creators were either like 13 or 14 year old kids who they hauled off the street and would work for pennies, or they were like 50 year old cartoonists who had come to the end of a natural career. So there was nobody to tell them what to do or what to draw. And it's why you get literally insane creations. And whenever there is a really creative period in comics, it's almost like they recreate that utter freedom. It's almost not a matter of somebody greenlighting the ideas. It's like there's not even an adult on the premises. it's all the kids are going wild.
You know, I'm a huge fan of like golden age and pre-code horror stuff. So, you know, I love that feel of comics where the literally anything goes and you can get away with most anything.
Yeah.
Do you think that the modern era and the way like more independent comic publishers like Image and IDW and stuff, do you feel like we're kind of entering another time when we could have like a new volume of regrettable superheroes because there is so much creative freedom with some of the other publishing companies?
I think you do have to dive deep to get like Images. I know that they publish a lot of indie and small press creators, and that's great. I do think of them more as a showcase than as a house of ideas. But if you go deep, you do find like I was thinking about Copra, which was one of the most exciting books when it came out. And it was and I'm going to mispronounce his name terribly, but Mikhail Fief's take on John Ostrander's Suicide Squad from the 80s. And it was turned out to be one of the most exciting books I ever read. And it was just published by a dude out of his apartment in Brooklyn. So I think if you dive deep into stuff that's really off the beaten path, oh yeah, you come up with books that I can barely describe. The fact that somebody wrote My Boyfriend is a Bear,
which is an astonishing amazing book.
It's an amazing book. It deserves its accolades. And I don't know who published that, to be honest. I think that was IDW, right?
I think so. That sounds right.
Yeah.
I would have to put it on air, but I'm not going to.
We do that on our podcast all the time. Nice. And it infuriates listeners. We love it. We are in a tremendous area of productivity. If I had to compare it to anything, I would say it's the black and white boom of the 80s. Because another era that I really love is that. I love guys like, you know, Chris Silver, who ran Silver Wolf Graphics and was just producing hundreds of black and white comics that nobody heard about. And that's kind of what happens now with the internet making printing and distribution so easy, or so much easier anyway, and so many tools to speed up the process so that people with like full-time jobs can come home and do a comic in 2 or 4 hours a night. We have an amazing number of amazing amount of creativity in comics happening on the outside, still producing amazing books that you can like easily access if as long as you traffic those grounds. I just read The Morning Star by this guy whose name I can't pronounce, and it's fantastic. One of the best comics I've ever read. Never really heard about it. Not made by a major publisher. Incredibly creative. I love it.
You know, that's one of my favorite things when we go to comic book conventions is to just wander up and down the artist alley. And when I see somebody whose art grabs me, I immediately look to see if they have like a self-published book, because right. I want to read, does their art match like their, you know, words, or are they working with somebody else to create like some bizarre thing? And I've found some amazing books that I never would have seen if I wouldn't have just been wandering around aimlessly as opposed to hanging out in the Marvel booth or something like that.
Exactly. I mean, there's a lot of Marvel in DC I really love. I'm not reading as much as I was a few years ago because I'm reading millions of Golden Age comics to write books about them. But yeah, the further away you wander from Marvel and DC, the wonders you find. You know, even stuff that's been really popular in the why was I going to call it the side stream outside of the mainstream for decades that maybe you haven't encountered. It's a wonderful medium, just tremendous works of art created in, you know, this medium we love so much.
So you love comics a lot in the same way that me and our listeners love comic books. So I feel like this question is going to be kind of like asking you which is your favorite child. But in the Regrettable Sidekicks book, what's the one that you were just like, this is amazing and I love this the most?
So it is tempting to say Woozy Winks or Volstagg, who are, you know, long running popular sidekicks and characters I've loved for a long time, and who've gotten some mainstream exposure, so folks might know them. But yeah, I have a tendency to go for the more forgotten ones. I think today I'm feeling Mutant Force. Are you familiar with Mutant Force?
I am not.
Mutant Force. Are a team of Marvel Comics mutants. They are villains. They are henchmen. They've worked for Magneto. They've worked for the United States government. They've worked for the Mandrill, who was in the Legion of Regrettable Supervillains. He was a giant baboon man. They are creations of the great Jack Kirby. And because of that, you want them to be touched with greatness. Unfortunately, they were just kind of whipped out for a Captain America annual. So they have literally the worst names in the history of mutant supervillains. They are, and this is Stan Lee's fault. Like, you know, Stan was brought these characters and told to name them, and he gave them terrible names. But they are Peeper, Lifter, Burner, Slither. Oh no, I'm going to forget the fifth. I've really forgotten the fifth. But the point is, they all have incredibly boring names, and they all look like basically like middle-aged engineers who put on spandex costumes one day.
Yep.
And largely they don't win. They just are not very good henchmen. They beat the Hulk, and that's it. Otherwise, the Defenders just destroy them. They're beaten up by Hellcat at her own wedding. They are not a team that does very well, but you have to kind of admire the advertised on tin quality. When you meet a guy named Burner, guess what his superpower is?
He burns stuff.
He burns. Yep, nailed it. So big fan of those guys right now.
So I've turned to the page. It's Pepper, Lifter, Slither, Burner, and Shocker.
Shocker. Shocker, whose power is he's shocking.
Shocks things.
That's it. Yeah. I was flipping through the book looking for it to get to the name, and I was reminded, too, of Itty, who older readers might remember as Green Lantern's turnip friend, who just looked like a potato, sort of like a sweet potato crossed with a starfish, frankly crossed with a penis. And he rode around on Green Lantern's shoulder for about a year and a half, maybe 2 years in the 1970s, confusing a lot of children.
Yeah. Oh, man. Like, that's not where that's supposed to be.
Gosh darn it, Hal. That goes lower. Yeah.
So when you're compiling these books, how difficult is it to like thin them into the size of book they are? Because as a lifelong comic books fan, I can guarantee you that I could look through my personal collection and find this many regrettable superheroes or villains or sidekicks just on my own. Like, what is the process like of saying this goes in the book and this does not?
It is. It does start with a very long list. I didn't keep track of how he did on sidekicks, but I remember there were 1,000 entries in the original list for the superheroes book.
Wow.
And that my editor, Rick Chalot, and I go through those lists, and it's just a matter of we try to get rid of anybody who is a duplication, anybody we can't say something new about. Sometimes a lot of the regrettable characters we come up with are, you know, genuine, not even regrettable, offensive or insulting, or, you know, especially in the villains book we came up with in the 19, really through the 40s through the 70s, you come up with a lot of racist caricatures. So a lot of those have to get cut out. Yeah, it's the process of building the list takes about 2 to 3 weeks, and the process of trimming it down takes maybe twice as long.
Are there arguments where you're like, no, this one I love?
Yeah, we had a couple. And I'm my editor told me I might get I'm not going to tell you which entries. My editor told me I might get some negative feedback on two of the characters who were included. Nope. No, everybody's fine. The only character I've ever received negative feedback for including was Dollman. So far, so good.
Oh, that's really weird because that's such a weird idea anyways.
It is. Well, I'll tell you, the guy who was giving me a lot of shine about Dollman, and I don't say this judgmentally, I just say this as an explanation. It was on Amazon. It was a real excoriation. He really was into Dollman. And when I followed him back to his he had a link to name and he had an author page, and he writes erotic fiction about giant women and tiny men.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So again, that's an explanation. I'm not criticizing. I say, if that's your life, yes, the inclusion of Dollman would be very insulting. So I see the point. I see the point.
So if there were to be a fourth volume in this regrettable series, what direction do you think you would take it?
Oh, we got to be done by this point. I can't imagine the posse of regrettable cowboys is coming anytime soon. I've been thinking for the last month, you know, December is a nice month to write your pitches for the upcoming year. And I would really love to write a good guide for how to collect weird comics, because there's good guides out there for collecting comics in general. But, you know, like you asked the question about how do you find these things? How do you sort through these things? There is kind of an art to even deciding what constitutes a weird comic book, you know, considering how weird a mainstream comic can be sometimes. So I think I'd kind of like to write that. And that would give me an opportunity to talk about things that fell outside the purview of the regrettable heroes. I'd love to talk about, you know, PSA comics. Or I have a wonderful collection of career-based comics where Popeye and Sweet Pea walk you around the wonderful world of careers. And it's like 15 volumes.
Huh.
I'd love to write about that, or all the stories where Ghost Rider and Spider-Man teach you about sexual abuse or literacy. Or
I have several like science fiction advertisement comics, like Major Inupiaq, things like that.
Oh, Major Inupiaq is a great example. I wrote about Captain Tootsie briefly in the first volume, but this would be a great opportunity to talk about things like Major Inupiaq that are whole books. I have a collection of Baskin-Robbins comics, which are, I mean, they're awful. They're just clearly written to be given away with ice cream. But there's something really compelling about the absence of care that was put into them.
Just literally, this is a vehicle for you to buy more ice cream, but we're not going to put any thought into this. That's
it really is.
How the Major Inupiaq book feels. It's like, this is an advertisement, period.
Yeah. What is a... I'm going to blank on it. There was a gas company that produced one of these books where a superhero shrinks a grandfather and his grandson down to tiny size so they can walk inside the gas tank and talk about how wonderful gasoline is, which would kill you.
Yeah, I have not heard of this book. I need to find it.
It's on my website somewhere. I'll hunt it down. I have 1,000 comics reviewed on my blog at this point, so I can no longer remember half the things I wrote. It's a wonderful problem to have.
So, John.
Yes, sir.
How can people find you? How can people find the book? Like, what are some ways that we can read some of these great reviews that, you know, you've done? Any other venues that we can listen to you on? You know, because it sounds like you have fascinating stories, but also a million things going on at once.
I certainly do. Thank you for asking. Well, I tell you what, if you just type the words Calamity John into the internet, 9 times out of 10, you find me, which is nice. You can also go to my website, calamityjohn.com, and I'm very active on Twitter and Instagram under the name Calamity John. You can find all three volumes, The League of Regrettable Superheroes, The Legion of Regrettable Supervillains, and The League of Regrettable Sidekicks on your better online booksellers like Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Amazon is where all the good reviews happen and where the fights occur every now and again, so that'll be nice. If you would like to read reviews of comics, or like I'm doing right now, I'm writing recaps of the USA Network 1990 to 1993 Swamp Thing television show. Oh, it's, you write about it long enough and you start to like it.
Yeah.
I say that as a warning.
Like, I have a Swamp Thing tattoo. Like, I'm a big Swamp Thing fan, and I have a hard time loving that show.
It's rough. But I tell you, Mark Lindsay Chapman plays Anton Arcane and is just playing it like he's on all the drugs. It's great.
What drugs is he on? All.
Everything. Yeah. Which, we did a drug test and he just maxed it out.
Yeah.
No, he's really, I don't want to actually say that he's on drugs because he's doing a fantastic and deliberate job as a complete psychopath, and it's wonderful. But so that's Gone and Forgotten, which is on goneandforgotten.blogspot.com, or you just type Gone and Forgotten into the internet. I've been here a long time. Or if you would like to hear me talk about the television show Columbo, which is my podcast, which has 2 episodes left to go, you can find that on jomtpodcast.com. That's Just One More Thing. And I think that's everything I do.
Oh, that's awesome. Just so you know, so you don't feel weird, on our podcasting network, we have a whole podcast just about Quantum Leap. So your Columbo podcast fits right in, man.
I'm all for it. Okay, that's good to hear.
Oh, man. Well, John, thank you so much for being on the show. I genuinely love your books. Like, they're really funny to me. And I always find something in them that I'm like, I need to go hunt that down. That's amazing.
That's so really rewarding. That is exactly why I wrote it. I'm so happy to hear that.
Well, John, if you do come out with your collection of how to collect weird comic books, we need to get you back on the show because I need more tips on how to figure out my weird collection because that is all I collect is weird shit. So thanks again for being on the show, man.
Oh, thank you so much. It was really a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Thinking Outside the Long Walks podcast. Join us on Facebook and Twitter to get behind-the-scenes information for exclusive content and to be notified when new episodes are available. The thoughts and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual and do not necessarily represent or reflect those of the Thinking Outside the Long Walks podcast, Barron Space Productions, its partners, or affiliates. The Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast is made available by its creators, Juan, John, and Gabe. The podcast is edited and produced by Juan, and Albie is the co-executive producer. The Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast is a Barron Space production.